Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm very grateful for the invitation to speak here, and we do owe a lot in Scotland to the Population Investigation Committee. I'll start with an apology, though. I'm a medically trained psychologist, not at all a historian, so this is just a psychologist looking back, not by any means a professional work of history. Secondly, I do want to talk about the Scottish Mental Surveys, but I will largely go to the extent that, in fact, the Population Investigation Committee informed the second of these two. No. And the thread here is going to be Professor Sir Godfrey Thompson, whom Ed Ramsden mentioned, and this is another photograph of him. And Thompson's interests were the theory of human intelligence differences, measuring human intelligence differences, how intelligence tests were used in educational selection, intelligence and population change, and he also was an extremely good basic psychometrician, a statistician, and worked with very talented mathematicians to inform those statistics. And just as a brief summary of him, he's usually described in the Scots phrase, a lad of pairts, meaning a boy from humble origin. His father left quite early on. His mother brought him up on her own. And he was a pupil teacher, this scheme whereby a bright 13-year-old was spotted to be groomed through a career into teaching and perhaps a degree. In fact, he took a maths and physics degree. His PhD in physics was in Strasbourg. By 1920, he was professor of education at Armstrong College, later to become Newcastle University, but at that time part of Durham. From 1925 to 51, he was Bell Professor of Education at the University of Edinburgh and head of the Murray House Teacher Training College. He had a 30-plus year argument with Charles Spearman about the interpretation of the general intelligence factor and made a contribution to the statistics of factor analysis. And in school selection, Thompson was actually really interesting. He wasn't actually in agreement with it, but he thought it was the least bad option to use some sort of test that wasn't about school learning to try and identify bright children from poor backgrounds. He actually did head up and was the creative genius behind a Murray House test industry, and he was heavily involved, as I shall show, in the Scottish Mental Surveys of 1932 and 47. But that's quite often said of Thompson as well, that he was much more at home, given he was a teacher, with 3.999 pupils than with four, reflecting the fact that he was particularly interested in statistics. Now, I shall refer as I go through to some primary sources that we've been able to identify about Thompson, because Thompson lacks any kind of an archive, and the historical work I'll describe here, in partnership with Martin Lawn, who's an educational historian at Edinburgh, now at Oxford too, and with David Bartholomew from the London School of Economics, we've been trying to collect materials on Thompson, and it includes this letter. It's an interesting one from his early years. It's from 1919, and it offers him a job, sight unseen, at £350 a year, and a letter a few weeks later actually ups the offer when he first refuses it. It's got a couple of interesting characteristics too. You see this cross here. This is where Thompson has scored out the P that's incorrectly been put in his name. And what he did in writing back to these individuals, he put a P in the centre of their surname. No matter what the surname actually was. And it's not quite so amusing when you see who actually wrote this letter. It's Carol Pearson offering him a job, because he saw from his publications he was an extremely bright young man and should be forward. But what happened in Scotland, as Ed described, as a remarkable set of investigations, happened partly because of Thompson, I believe, but also because of two other things. First of all, the concatenation of people that happened to be there at that time. James Grieber, psychologist, Rusk through in Glasgow, an educationalist, William McClelland, psychologist, Vernon and Raven, psychologists, and William Boyd, an educationalist. Thompson also collected on his side, on the right-hand side here, Bill Emmett, Walter Lederman, Derek Lawley and Harry McFarland, all very talented statistical analysts. In fact, Walter Lederman and Derek Lawley, actually mathematicians. So Thompson was one of these people who intuitively could look at a problem and work it out statistically, but knew then how to get a very good mathematician formally to prove it as well. And also the other thing that was there in Scotland was this remarkable organisation, the Scottish Council for Research and Education, which started in 1928 and is in fact still going, that effectively made Scotland a national research network that cost next to nothing. It started off, if I recall correctly, as a penny farthing from the Educational Institute of Scotland subvention from each teacher per week. And the research was funded according to that. I should also say, for those who are interested, that the three of us, Martin Lawn, David Bartholomew and I, have been writing historical papers on Thompson and his circle over the last few years, and I'm quite happy to send any of these to those who are interested, and some of the work today draws on this list of papers. But anyway, back to Thompson. When I said he had a Murray House test industry, this is an example. This is the what was called Room 70 at Murray House. This was Thompson's research room where he paid for his researchers from the profits from the Murray House testing industry. He drew up a contract quite early on in which he would not get any money from these Murray House tests, though he was sending down hundreds of thousands of these tests a year, testing mainly in England. And this is one of his annual reports, commendably short, I have to say, compared with the annual reports I have to provide to my funders. But this is an annual report from 1938. It says there that they tested or sent tests to 29 English education authorities. They devised new intelligence, arithmetic and English tests and carried out 10 empirical investigations. And that's the end of it. And it's Godfrey Thompson and Bill Emmett who actually signed the report. And other primary sources that we've come across, and this doesn't reproduce, and I've actually got it in two forms, that's minimally better. We discovered a four-page pencil-written account by Thompson near the end of his career, where he summed up what his research was about. And as far as today's Population Investigation Committee is concerned, this second one is important, where he says he was interested in B, the social and geographical distribution of intelligence and the influence of the differential birth rate. So he names that as one of his three chief research interests in his entire career. Now, the Scottish Mental Surveys start with the Conference on Examinations funded by Carnegie in 1931 at an Eastbourne hotel. And this sees Scotland punching way above its weight in terms of international educational research. This is a gathering funded by Carnegie and pretty much run by Thorndike that actually looks at the problem of measuring ability or aptitude for further education and then measuring the outcomes of educational success. And there's Scotland with Godfrey Thompson amongst some others at it. But look at the others that are there from Switzerland. Piaget is a member of that committee. From the United States, you can see various people you might recognise, but Edward L. Thorndike is running the show. From England, just about any one of these names is to conjure with, but there's Cyril Burt and Charles Spearman, who are closest to my interest, but also Sir Michael Sadler is there from England as well. And there they are gathered, and I always fail to spot these when I'm speaking. There's Godfrey Thompson there. There's Spearman looking off in some distant direction there. And there's Edward Thorndike there. And this is them gathering, talking about the problems of measurement in education. And what they do is they give each country from Europe and America a job to do. And Scotland's job is to measure the intelligence of the entire nation. They decide that's what Scotland's job is going to be. And it will conduct the first ever entire measurement of a nation's intelligence. And so in the 1932 mental survey test, it takes place on Monday, June the 1st, 1932, and it tests 87,498 children on the same mental test, which takes 45 minutes, potential score of 76, which no one actually obtains, although we've now had some of the 8-year-olds follow up, get a maximum score of 76. And that's it. And they go back and they report back, I've shown one or two of the questions here, from the test. I say the maximum score is 76. Here's a little three-term series problem, a coding problem, and here's a question which says, what number is in the triangle in the square but not in the circle? It's still a copyrighted test. which means I can't give you the answer. And so they write it up in 1933 in this book called The Intelligence of Scottish Children. It tests about 95% of the population who at school in Scotland on that day. And they go back and they also report back to the second conference on examinations in 1935, and it's moved to Folkestone this time. Now, the unusual thing about this conference on examinations, the transcripts of which were discovered again by Martin Lawn, is they recorded every utterance that took place at these conferences. Every utterance is recorded. And so it's rather, sorry, I think it's at this one, that in fact the Scottish contingent, which lacks tomes from this side, gets, to be frank, rather mauled by a fairly on-form Charles Spearman at one point, and every single blow is recorded. And other work about Thomson around this time shows that he was very, very highly regarded. Here's Thorntyke writing to Russell over in Carnegie in Columbia, saying that it would seem unfortunate to give $45,000 to Thurstone, L.O. Thurstone at that time, and give nothing to either Kelly or Godfrey Thomson. And here's another thing from the Carnegie archive, which says, Thorndike says that Godfrey Thomson at Edinburgh is tops and needs the help. And here's something else from the Carnegie Foundation's archives in America as well. And I'll just read this one out. The bottom substantial paragraph there is talking about giving $1,000 to the French and $5,000 to the Scots. But it says as follows, having done, remember, the Scottish Mental Survey of 1932 already, it's thinking about should we shove more money at these Scots. It says the allocation of $5,000 to the Scottish Committee will, I believe, be money well spent. No national committee has surpassed the Scottish in thoroughness of work, sympathetic understanding of the problem before it, and excellence of results. Moreover, the Scots seem to make their money go very far indeed. although by pinching they could get along with less, I think superior results can only be obtained by granting the full amount of $5,000. And there, they moved to France, and the Germans aren't there anymore for obvious reasons, but they moved to France in 1938, and that's the last of the international conferences on examinations. And once again, we see Thompson there, and Spearman keeping his distance, being over the other side of the photograph. And then we come to the Population Investigation Committee. So what you have to remember is the Scots have measured the intelligence of the population. And the aims of the Scottish Mental Survey of 1947, as it says here, at the annual general meeting of the Scottish Council for Research and Education in June 45, Professor Thompson brought to the attention of the Research Council a suggestion made by Fraser Roberts and conveyed to Professor Thompson by Sir Alexander Carr Saunders, chairman of the PIC, that in view of the presumed decline of national intelligence by reason of the differential birth rate, the Research Council, that is, the Scottish Council for Research and Education, should undertake a repetition of the 1932 Mental Survey, applying the same test to the corresponding age group to secure evidence as to whether there had been any change since the original application. Now, it's actually a bit more detailed than that, because in July 45, this is Thompson writing. This is from your excellent archive. I wanted to show that we've been down, some of our researchers and myself, looking at this superb archive. And I've looked at this only from the point of view of the Scottish mental surveys and their follow-ups, not from the entirety of PIC. And a couple of interesting things with this letter. First of all, let me just summarise it for you. Thompson is saying, don't measure the entire population again. He's actually saying, measure a smaller study that was done slightly later than the Scottish Mental Survey. And also interestingly, he gets the year wrong. Having been involved with it, I've seen his hand calculations of pages and pages of statistics. He says it's 1920. And it was the survey of 1931 based on people born in 1920. And also rather farsightedly at the bottom there, he's saying, this could easily be repeated. This is the smaller study that he wants them to follow up. Every 25 years for the next 200 years. Now, there's far thinking. This is what he's proposing. And another interesting thing about this is he also says the 1931 survey, this to test the entire nation, cost £1,000. And I've calculated that into today's cost, and it would be the price of a fairly cheap research associate for a year or two. So it would, even today, it wouldn't buy you a great deal, so it's extremely cheap. And then And the other thing was, you might have noticed the slightly odd address, and part of the reason we do have quite a lot on Thompson now is that he spent July, August and September and a whole sabbatical year in 1937 at his holiday home at the old schoolhouse in Glenapp over in faraway Ayrshire. And that's it recently when I went to visit it, in fact. And so we have quite a lot of written record for Thompson. But this, as you'll see, is a letter from D.V. Glass. And just to go back, and he's writing to Godfrey Thompson actually saying, I don't agree with you. I think instead of following up your little survey, the only way to do this is to follow up the entire nation once again to get good results. And it goes on at some length. And at the same time, and again, this is August 1945, this is Glass, again, writing to Carr Saunders, as you see at the Population Investigation Committee, again saying that Fraser Roberts doesn't agree with Thompson, and they want Thompson and the Scottish Council for Research and Education to once again measure the entire nation's intelligence. And they get their way, because the Scottish Mental Survey overturns Thompson's ideas. And in fact, they meet, and I'll tell you who. There's an Edinburgh conference on March 16, 1946. The Scottish Council for Research and Education Director, Robert Rusk, and the Executive Committee of SCRE meet with three PIC members, Carr Saunders, Fraser Roberts and Glass. The funding is, again, it sounds rather small for what they then carry out, is £2,000 from the Nuffield Foundation and £2,000 from the Eugenics Society. They appoint a committee to do the Scottish Mental Survey of 1947, and they make Thompson the chairman. The Scottish Council for Research and Education itself pays for the publication of the thing, and its publication outlet was the University of London Press. And the idea, they had to then persuade, they had to bring on board all the directors of education. Now, they're coping with the 1946 Education Act in Scotland and putting into place all these things, and they really don't want to do it, one gets the impression from reading the minutes at the time. And the letter actually stresses, as I say there in double inverted commas, the social and national significance of the possible intelligence decline. This is how it is sold to directors of education. And then they want to add value with applying a sociological survey that David Glass puts together for a random sample. And this is the sticking point. At this point, there is a no, we cannot do this survey. And then they have to have a delegation of Glass, Fraser Roberts and Godfrey Thompson to the Teachers Executive Committee to persuade them to do this additional sociological survey. Because I have to stress, this costs almost nothing. The teachers do the scoring, the marking, the sending it all back, and they actually get organised by them as well. This is when I'm not, I hope I'm not exaggerating when I say Scotland turns into a research network at this time. It's all largely done gratis. The Scotsman has a bit of a laugh about it as well. In 1946, September, before it takes place, they say the council, that is the Scottish Council for Research and Education, think it might be worthwhile finding out if a decline takes place in the nation's intelligence. They then go on to talk about how nobody actually seems bothered about whether intelligence is actually increasing as opposed to decreasing. However, this is interesting, hasn't been mentioned today so far. This is Godfrey Thompson writing to Blacker. And you see the phrase quite early on in this letter. This is 47 before the survey takes place. And quite early on in the letter, he mentions the phrase, the Galton subsidy. And the idea here was that there's going to be a Galton subsidy to encourage poor families with bright children to have more children and to get them to higher education. And Thompson's writing back saying, I think we probably could in Scotland identify some families for a possible Galton subsidy. He also writes to Blacker along the following lines that he's looked at England and he finds a strong negative correlation between the scores they get on his Murray House tests and the birth rates of those particular education authorities as well. In fact, the correlation there is minus 0.6 between the birth rate of the areas and the test scores they get. Anyway, it happens on Wednesday, June the 4th, 1947, as Ed was saying, absolutely spot on, Ed, it's 70,805 individuals, again about 95% of the population born in 1936, take the Scottish Mental Survey of 1947. It's the same test as was applied in 1932, and they were desperate, the Murray House Test Office in Edinburgh, that nobody should use this test again and it shouldn't get out, so nobody would have seen it effectively for the best part of 15 years. And it says here in the Scottish Council for Research and Education book that was written up of the survey in 1947, The inquiry reported in this volume was begun in the hope that it might throw light on the causes of a remarkable quantitative social fact, namely, that the results of intelligence tests show that the average score of members of large families is less than that of members of small families. It was feared this might be leading to a steady fall in national intelligence if its causes that intelligent parents are limiting their families. If, on the other hand, its causes environmental, it's a duty to discover this and strengthen the hand of the social reformers. In either case, the phenomenon is important, and to show beyond doubt that it really exists would be itself worthwhile, just effectively what you're saying, Ed. Now, this next quotation is important because Martin Lawn and I have managed to track down various people that worked with Godfrey Thompson, either in their 80s or their 90s now. And here's John Nisbet, later Professor of Education at Aberdeen. He was involved in the 47 survey, and this is what he said about it in 2006. This is John speaking from a transcript of the interview that Martin and I carried out with him. The 1947, now there I was, of course, much more closely involved. And for me at that time, and I think for a lot of others, we saw it as a big test of national intelligence. That idea that the large families were, the people at the bottom end of intelligence scale were having large numbers of children, and the professional people were not having any at all, or hardly having, limiting their family, and the result would be that national intelligence would decline. That was the key argument. You know that right up to 1960-something, university staff who had got £50 a year extra for each child they had, we had two children. I got £100 added to my salary because I had two children. So there was effectively a Galton subsidy at that point. And there's a result that Ed told us about. And that's exactly as they published it in the 1949 book. There was the mean for 1932, and there was the mean for 1947. In fact, it had gone up by just under 2 points. And it's probably the first and most comprehensive demonstration of what's now called the Flynn effect, the national or the international rise in intelligence test scores across much of the 20th century. And here, I've redrawn the results of the Scottish Mental Survey of 1947 that show that intelligence was empirically affected by family size, but hardly at all by family position. Because here are the scores of the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth born for different sizes of families, if you'll excuse that paradox. Here's single families, families with two children scoring about 42, three scoring just under 40, families of four, which I belong to, scoring about 36, then five, then six. They remarked there was a very small effect, which you can probably see here, of the first and last in a family tending to have slightly higher scores, but far and away the biggest effect was family size, not family position. Is that clear to everyone how that's been redrawn? Scotland's the only place too, and this is by just taking this from the 1949 survey and putting it on a map of Scotland, they point out that there are geographical differences in IQ scores across Scotland. And these are scores I'm going to show which are means. They are means out of 76. And to do something non-controversial, first of all, I'll show the differences between Edinburgh and Glasgow. And the basic conclusion in the 1947 survey was that things get a bit worse west and north of Edinburgh, pretty much. But these are differences which they then discuss in terms of industrialisation and professionalisation and where people gather to work. Now, here's also a note from 1949 after the survey, and there's a letter prior to this where Thompson asks Blacker what was the rather cute Great Expectations type little nickname that he's got, and it's Pip. And from then on, he calls him Pip and not Blacker. And he says there he still thinks he can put the suggestion to the Scottish Council for Research and Education. There are some families they can identify for a eugenic society boost. And that these families, just at the end there, it says, with a view to the society doing some positive eugenical work by helping these families grow larger, spotted by their intelligence. But John Nisbet, in his interview with us, said something different. The really interesting thing about the 47 survey was not the follow-up and the reasoned hypothesis Thompson had for the population inquiry. The really interesting thing was that it provided a base for subsequent studies, and there were the study of the 1,000. And what's not often mentioned is that the 1947 Scottish Mental Survey produced not one book describing Surrey, but six books over 20 years. And I've written the history of this in the first chapter of this book, which came out in late 2009, called A Lifetime of Intelligence, published by the American Psychological Association. But to cut a long story short, it's interesting, over the 20 years of the 1947 Scottish Mental Survey Committee, the committee changes quite interestingly. Glass is on the committee right from the beginning and does travel up to Edinburgh to help them. But by the time they write the last book in 1969, James Maxwell authors the last of the six books called 16 Years On. Here are various contributors. Carter from the genetics unit in London, J.W.B. Douglas, whom we've heard about already, D.V. Glass, and Fraser Roberts. It's a much more UK-wide group this time, with a much wider group of interests. And it's then, in fact, that in the late 90s, myself and Professor Lawrence Wally, who was Professor of Mental Health in Aberdeen, actually, and I say this to my own shame, having worked in intelligence research for 15, 20 years before I actually came across these surveys, we discovered them in the basement of Murray House College of Education, where the Scottish Council for Research and Education had then moved. And along this corridor, we took a photograph. This is a reenactment, I emphasise, but this is the corridor it was in. And here were the survey ledgers. This is the Scottish Mental Survey of 1932, minus the Fife ledger, which went missing in the 1950s and we've never traced. And here are the 1947 ledgers. Here's what a page of the 32 survey looks like, all handwritten. I've taken this from my hometown in Carluke, and it contains my father's brother as one of the people. And the 47 survey note is typed by then. And also note that it has position in the family. It records the family size and position. But what I want to emphasise today is Glass's involvement here, D.V. Glass's involvement. He's the one that insisted on this four-page sociological survey. And what they did was this. They took, you've got the idea that the entire nation was measured. They wanted a random sample sociological survey to beef it up on the sociological side. So they took the people born on the first, second, and third of every month. So 12 months, first 3 days, they called it the 36-day sample, and all the twins. And they gave them this four-page sociological survey. There it is. They realised they didn't have the resources to score this. They closed Murray House for 3 days, and they set up trestle tables. And we've actually spoken quite recently to a student involved in this, and they just passed it down the line, and they each scored a little bit of the test as they passed it down. 3 days later, it was all done. D.V. Glass, it's recorded, himself actually scored the occupational classifications, and that's really very, very impressive. There's over 8,000 for him. Even more amazing is the six-day sample. The children born on the first of the even-numbered months, February, April, June, etc., six-day sample, there are 1,208 of them, they were given home interviews every year for 16 years. And the letters recording people actually going to some of these homes and finding people are absolutely extraordinary, as are some of the very occasional sad deaths from some of the young people that happen. And they actually found everyone, bar a few, over the 16-year period. And this is how we found the six-day sample in the late 90s. Some of them unwrapped for a couple of decades. The pink folders are for the girls. The blue folders are for the boys. They are. And when we opened them up, there were 16 years of records for every one of the 1,208 of the six-day sample. And so I want to finish by saying that we have been following up some of the individuals from the Scottish Mental Surveys. And this is, they've been following them up in Aberdeen, led by Professor Lawrence Wally, in whom I've collaborated. And I've been leading the ones in Edinburgh with Professor John Starr and Lawrence Wally. And we call the Edinburgh follow-up studies the Lothian birth cohorts. And this is the Lothian birth cohort of 1921. It's 550 strong, first recruited in 1999. And I've shown you Portobello School here. We've got three of the girls here who came along and were followed up. And this is one of the first reunions, 550 of them almost, sitting down to tea to hear the initial results. And we're trying to follow them up every 3 years approximately. And this year we're following up those that we can still bring in for testing near to the 90th birthday. And in fact, we've just started the first testings, and out of the first 25 letters that we've sent out, almost everybody who's able is actually coming in still to be tested at age 90. And I'll just show you, between the Lothian birth cohorts of 1921 and 1936, these follow-up studies of the Scottish Mental Surveys of 1932 and 47, we've published over 100 empirical research papers now. So you'll forgive me if I don't try and summarise all those data. I'll just pick up one thing that we could do that's unusual. Here, we did genetic testing on the people born in 1921, and we separated them into whether or not they contained a particular flavour of a gene which is predisposing towards dementia. And we were able to show that that particular flavour, having one flavour of the gene versus another, is associated with cognitive ability at age 80 almost, but not at age 11. And that appeared in Nature early in the 2000s. It's a remarkable study. You could study intelligence across 70 years and show that, in fact, the genetic contribution is not the same at different ends of the lifespan. And as I said earlier, we've written up the first 10 years of our research in a lifetime of intelligence. And here's a picture taken in 1947 of a group of children that took the survey. And this young man took the survey and got a high score. And he's helped us in recruiting people for the Lothian birth cohort 1936 very kindly. And it's Richard Wilson. And here's some of the Lothian birth cohort of 1947 being filmed for the Scottish television news. We got the 1,091 of them that we recruited together, and we tried to get them together as we did for the 60th anniversary of taking the test on the 4th of June 2007. And this is one of the subjects who's allowed his photograph to be shown. So this is what Mr. Simpson looked like when he first took the test. Then he came back to see us at age 70. And we tested 1,091 people between 2004 and 7, followed them up 3 years later. We've just finished doing that for wave two between 2008 and 10. And we're just starting testing in a month or two over the next couple of years as well. So let me tell you a wee bit about what we do on them. And I knew time would be short today and I would overrun with this huge number of slides. So instead of giving you lots and lots of lists, I'm just going to summarize. With 1947, we see these individuals for 2 half days. And these are long half days. They're seen individually by a psychologist and a research nurse. They undergo about 2 hours of cognitive testing. We do a brain scan that lasts over an hour and a quarter. We take pictures of the backs of the eyes. We take a very long diet survey. We test their senses. We test their fitness. We take blood for many different things. We measure the body. And we do 610,000 genetic tests on every single individual as well. Okay, so that's the extent of what we do. And you can imagine my research team is now large in terms of looking at them. But here's, for example, what we've been able to do is furnish the longest ever correlations of giving the identical same intelligence test across more than 70 years of life. And the correlations are astonishingly high. It in fact shows that about 50% of the variance, if you square these correlations, is stable across most of the human life course. It also means for those of us interested in cognitive aging, which is what I'm interested in, it means that half of it is unstable. And so one is seeking the determinants of cognitive change across that very long period of life. I thought I'd just throw this in too, because we are interested in social mobility, and we do it using structural equation modelling family background through the person's IQ at age 11, through their educational experiences, through their occupation, eventually to their mental ability tests at age 70. We try and understand how these things mediate the effects of the other. I'm not even going to try and explain this, but just to show that we are interested in formally trying to model the process of social mobility and how that affects cognitive function in old age, as well as looking at genetic and health, etc., effects on these things. And it's attracted, just winding up, some individuals as well. This is last year, Jim Watson of Watson and Crick fame, if I need to say that, came and spent a day with us studying the work of the Scottish Mental Surveys of 1932 and 1947. So just acknowledge ESRC, who funded the historical work I've presented today and the other funding organisations that support the empirical research that's going on in the Scottish Mental Survey follow-ups of 32 and 47. That's it. Thanks.